Hello, it's Chief. Show the face to all the Covenant and Dr. Catherine Halsey. You've been here, helmet in your arms, and a rogue blue AI. Halo season two's arrived. We've come to chat about the vibes and tell you how are we. If you watch or you game, buddy, don't matter. You clearly are here to reclaim all the lore.
Reach the Planet and Reach Season 2, Episode 4 of Halo are both over, but here on Post Show Recaps, we are just getting started. My name is Corey B, and I'm here holed up in an antique shop with my friend and co-host, Rich Filiberto, the great DM Philly. Rich, how are you doing today?
I'm pretty hype, Corey. I'm ready for the battle of Reach right here. Point me at him, man. Give me a plasma cannon, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Let's pick up an energy sword and let's get going. Maybe watch out for the guy at the side, though. we had a very this is what I hoped for in a battle episode. The first domino to fall in the Fall of Reach. Really excited for this. We've had several portrayals of this in the Halo universe between books and games. Rich, what was it like for you as the plasma cannon started raining down on the planet?
I love a good action set piece, you know, and you and I were just talking about episode 3 last week. I thought they did such a good job building the anticipation. Like, the tension felt really palpable as we got into it. And I thought it was pretty good, man. They went for like a lot of long shots. The blocking was like pretty clean on some of these fight scenes. Pablo is like Master Chief. Like, that guy's big. There's not enough shots of him next to everybody else to reframe how gigantic he is, you know? And so I talked about it last week with this notion of him out of the armor as a weapon. I really liked that they were like stripped down from their gear. That felt like stakes and danger. And so pretty big, right? It's like a big sprawling action set piece for just about the whole episode that I thought was pretty effective as like a newcomer watching the Fall of Reach for the first time.
Absolutely. And I totally agree. We had this so many moments where they were separated from their armor. We saw them as humans fighting, but it felt real. It didn't feel forced, right? Obviously, they are probably going to want to get these actors and have practical effects for a lot of what's going on. It could be a budget thing, could be an actor thing, but I didn't feel that during the episode. I felt that there was a legitimate reason for John and these other Spartans to be running around without their armor. And it just adds to the stakes because Spartans are so immensely powerful that they are taking on these Covenant forces without their armor on. Mm-hmm. It was awesome. And I thought it worked really, really well. And like you said, just to the point we were talking about last week, they really amped it up and I loved it. I think so many Halo fans were wanting an episode like this. We'll see what the sort of larger reaction is, but an actual episode where there is conflict the entire time. Obviously, this is a show. We cannot get that every episode, but I do think that this is one that people will have been waiting for. And we don't know exactly where it'll go from here, but I think this was the action shot for sure. Probably another one coming in the season, but this one is great.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying, you know, to come in with like a positive perspective as I'm watching Halo. I'm looking for the stuff that I'm digging, you know. Yeah. I think that like some of the action scenes that we got, the episode one was really great as we got like that battle of Chief just kind of coming into the grounds. But two was a little bit like in the dark, in the fog, that like kind of ambiguous, generic CGI kind of set piece.
Sure.
So this felt like great, right? There were shades of like, gosh, some of the Obi-Wan Kenobi episodes. Like, it felt like that Star Wars Blade Runner lived in urban landscape of like this hyper megalopolis, you know, just those world building elements really felt like granular, and I could feel like some texture to them, which I appreciate. And, you know, in the critiques that I have seen of the show so far from the pretty stalwart fans, it's the lack of this kind of stuff, right? The overemphasis on like some of the character building that is not as effective for them when it's especially with people that are not from canon, right? And so being able to like actually do the thing and get some like cannons blasting, giant explosions, like ships, like, yeah, this is the stuff, right? This is what like you guys spent thousands of hours grinding away on those controllers. So like, I don't blame folks for like being delighted to see it. And I hope it's received well, because it felt like a pretty well constructed hour of action, you know?
Absolutely. And to that end, characters dying in this episode as well. So a lot of stakes, and it really did feel like, and it, in an interesting way too, right? This is a battle that feels sort of reminiscent of the games, but in the same way, to your point, like without the armor and things, it felt like a real narrative story that we wouldn't maybe be able to sort of encounter less in the games. This is not exactly how the Fall of Reach goes in the novels. No surprise there. This is a different timeline. And there's actually a game called Halo Reach, which is sort of a prequel. Halo, the first Halo game takes place a little bit after the Fall of Reach, like right after, in fact, basically escaping from Reach. And in Halo Reach, you were sort of on a team called Noble Team rather than Silver Team that we're following around today. Chief is sort of on Reach, but we don't really, at least not in the games, follow him around. So it's kind of fun to like explore a different perspective and a different narrative. And despite the fact that the storylines are different, I think that we got a lot of great stuff out of the characters that we had, and lost some things I wasn't expecting. We'll definitely get into that too. But there's some things we'll talk about for sure, but overall I had a lot of fun here.
Yeah, me too. A strong episode, you know. I was very eager to see what they were going to do, and I feel like they delivered pretty well, you know. Along these like last two, like I was pretty thumbs up on episodes 1 and 2. I enjoyed 3, and this was solid, you know. Like I'm eager to see where we go into 5.
Absolutely. And one thing before we get into the plot that I want to just underscore the entire thing with is that a very interesting story is that we never see Kai the entire episode. And it was after that scene last episode where she was sort of asking Ackerson what she needs to do, right? Did she follow him on board his Condor and leave early? What's going on with her? They mention her briefly in the episode. John's like, oh, she's probably just out hunting Covenant, right? But I think something else interesting must be happening with her.
I do as well, especially when we're just looking at the episode 3 stuff. I'm glad you bring it up now just to talk about it for a minute before we get into the actual what we did see. But I really like Kai as a character. I find her so compelling. And just to jump ahead a little bit, but we're obviously going to lose Wand of Silver Team in a kind of critical way. And so her absence like was very notable to me. And as we're just tracking the pieces on the board, like Ackerson's off world, he left with all his resources, this whole speech to Halsey of like what you built will be the beginnings, the foundations. So it feels to me like she is probably nowhere near any of this. It has been like completely removed from this situation as like Ackerson's Master Chief in pocket, almost, of like waiting to kind of like put her in that position for whatever new Marines they're going to try to build. And that feels like a very interesting storyline. It could be, at least there's potential there that's compelling to me, you know.
I agree, and I definitely think the most likely place she is with Ackerson off world and contributing to whatever plan he has next, whether that's you know, a good thing for her or not. But I think that it's interesting too, because I think Silver Team is basically done, which is not something I would have even said last episode, right? Between Riz's injury and her sort of increasing desire to retire, Vanek. Now, spoiler alert for the plot, Vanek sadly does not make it through this episode, and now Kai is potentially defecting from Silver Team and sticking with Ackerson, although we don't know her motivations, and she certainly could be turned back around and reunited with John at some point. But it seems like Silver Team might sort of be like a thing of the past.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious. Obviously, I have no idea what the canon is like here. I know Master Chief is like the through line, and you've like illuminated that like the rest of our Silver Team characters are pretty much constructed for the show, right? So I'm curious, but I think it gives them, like I talked about last week a little bit, in the adaptation from the League of Legends game in Arcane, they had a lot of creative liberty and a lot of like leeway to kind of write story and build their own ground as they went. And I think that that's a feature, not a bug, right? Like, like, you know, Halo, like kind of course correcting for whatever feedback we got in season one in terms of where we want our emphasis. Like, we didn't spend a lot of time learning about Vanek, but I had said right off the rip, like, I'm really intrigued in this guy. I really dig this guy. And like, that's a loss I feel. It feels like pointed to me as a new viewer, you know? So I think in that way, it's effective, and it'll be interesting to track what Chief's journey out of this is. And it's hammering on that theme we've been talking about, which is like his identity, right? If we strip the title of Master Chief away, what does that make John? If we strip Silver Team away and take the armor off him, now really, what does that make him? And that's, you know, clearly part of what they're interested in exploring with this venue, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned sort of the difference between the games and the shows in terms of Silver Team, because in the game canon, John was not part of Silver Team. Of course, when Master Chief sort of wakes up from his cryo sleep in the first game of Halo, he basically is alone, right? He's the only Spartan there. He's one of a kind. And as the game progresses, you meet other Spartans. He was actually part of, I believe, Blue Team in the games, but all the other members of Blue Team before Reach was evacuated, before he gets to Halo, are gone. So in some ways it's different, but in some ways it is a little bit of a parallel, right? Where maybe he's becoming a little bit more of a lone wolf as he tries to escape Reach. And the other part of that is, you know, they do the whole sci-fi thing where, oh, it turns out Blue Team wasn't dead. They were just locked away on a Dyson sphere with, you know, with Dr. Halsey and all the, so like, you know, after some time they come back as characters do, when you realize you want to flesh out the universe, and maybe having one single Spartan from that program in the universe is maybe not enough. But you know, the original sort of storyline and throughput of Master Chief being a lone wolf by the time he gets out of Reach is sort of starting to align with the games. And I find that kind of interesting.
That's very fascinating. This notion of him like losing a team, or, you know, them like being removed, whether it's true or not. That's compelling. It's interesting. You know, I'm curious as to the trajectory from here, but I appreciate that we got such like a status quo upturning incident, like midstream here. I like when we can like flip the status quo on its head halfway through a season and watch that fall out. That's good drama.
It absolutely is. And we could continue chatting about this, but why don't we get a feel for how this battle rages on throughout the episode and the couple stops we make down along the way.
Take it away.
Let's do it. Corey B, take it away. We open the episode. We didn't get like a real character moment with Vanek last episode. We get a really awesome one here where he's climbing up high on a really tall building. He's feeding his pigeon supper. He's got Benny. He's got Jenny. He's got Lenny. And of course, he's got Keith. And he says Keith with like a little bit of disdain. He doesn't like Keith very much. But ultimately, they sort of start to freak out, the birds, and the explosions begin, just like we saw from John and Talia Perez. Again, the I don't think I need to explain who Talia Perez is at this point. She's running with John. She tries to go back to her house to check on her family, but everything sort of explodes. And throughout the episode, she is having these like dazed moments where she's sort of standing there not knowing what to do. She's freaking out, as one does when they see a giant plasma mortar destroy their family. And there will be plenty of moments where we stop down where Talia and John sort of talk about how this is just sort of a thing that happens in war. He says, they're gone. You got to move on. She says, how do you move on? They're my family. Like, they're not some other Marines I'm working with fighting in the war. These are civilians. These are my family. How do you do that? And so this is something that she constantly struggles with throughout the entire episode as she and John work their way up to Fleet Comm, their military headquarters here. And when they get there, she starts trying to warn people to leave because everything's kind of cool there so far. But then we start to see some invisible sort of like cloaked elites come through and people start to get thrown around. John, while unarmored, tackles one through a window and starts beating up on it. Again, these are the cooler, higher stakes that I'm talking about. One elite's not that big of a deal in the games, but here John runs to that window unarmored and starts beating on it. They have a fight. If Talia doesn't like slam it in the back at one point, John probably would not have had the upper edge to defeat it. So there's a really great scene there where they're sort of working together to take it on. Also, a small note here, there is a stunning like lack of music during these scenes, which I thought was incredible. It's a really great touch to this entire segment where there's just no backing music and you just hear all the chaos happening behind it. Or very limited. I didn't hear it if there was any. And then this was the scene I referenced in the beginning. John and Talia are sort of like running through. They're running upstairs and they hide out in what turns out to be an antique shop. John finds this old axe, so he uses it because they don't really have any guns or weapons at this point. And they have a little talk where John basically talks about why he doesn't flinch every time anything bad happens, all this death around him, and he's still just working hard. And he basically goes back to a scene we talked about a couple times in season 1, where Halsey knew John was lucky. She continuously flipped a coin. He continuously called it, and every time it was heads, 11 times in a row, called it each time. And she says what Halsey said, that he was lucky. But he said, no, I wasn't guessing. I knew. And it's always been like that. Every time I go into battle, I know that I can lose somebody, but I know that it's not going to be me. And she says, oh, that's got to be nice. But he's like, not really. it sounds cool, but I think in practice, yeah, I could see how maybe that's not the best. And then, we get a little chat with the antique shop owner. She's just chilling, right? She's talking about the axe being over 600 years old. Somebody actually used to cut wooden trees with this axe for fuel. Can you believe that? She is working with him there, having him help her get like an old typewriter moved. And basically they talk to her about how she needs to leave. And she refuses, basically saying that, all these relics have so much history. Objects here that have fought, survived communism and fascism and all the isms, and they've survived. And if that doesn't matter, then nothing matters. We don't matter if these things don't matter, which was obviously a very pointed conversation throughout this and sort of a purpose for, their understanding moving forward, especially John, I would imagine. And so, there's like a little aside there where thankfully nobody breaks through the door, but obviously they leave her to presumably get glassed eventually. And I should mention throughout all this, Captain Keyes, Admiral Keyes tells us this a little later, but the scene here is basically that they took out the comms tower that John tried to get to before so that they could deploy ground troops. They don't even know how many, but they still do have to sort of take down their MAC cannons. These are orbital cannons in space, which are like the anti-air space version, right? So their cruisers can't get close enough to the planet unless they do it. So the glassing hasn't officially began at this point. This is a ground-to-ground sort of combat right now, but the Covenant are seemingly vastly outnumbering the humans in this battle, and everything is still getting decimated in the meantime. So just to set the stage a little bit there as we keep talking, at this point, we run into some friendly faces. John grabs, first of all, he runs into Riz, who's on a turret fighting off the Covenant. He says his trademark line, I need a weapon, and grabs one. Riz is talking about the situation, and ultimately, she is with Lewis. And Danilo, I got it. Lewis and Danilo are both there. And so they say, we're not going anywhere. We're going with you. They push through the battleground and work together to fight around these Covenant. Lewis in particular, despite being blind, has a grenade launcher and knows how to use it. He takes out so many elites during this process. They're coming around from all sides, most of them with these awesome energy swords, working their way up a building. John throws a grenade, Riz throws a grenade, they do a diving window jump with Riz. A lot of really cool stuff here. And then they bring in the Covenant tank. This thing is called a Wraith. And in the games, they're very prevalent. It's this giant plasma fire tank. And they're sort of being pinned down by it. So Lewis sadly takes his sort of belt of grenades, walks up to it, and sacrifices himself to blow up this giant Wraith tank. Riz obviously freaks out from that, but John, again, being the voice of reason, saying, we gotta go, let's get out of here. So all this is happening. We have another through line here with Soren and Dr. Halsey, who at the end of last episode, we saw Soren being introduced by Ackerson to Halsey, presumably as some sick, twisted way of, again, bringing all of Halsey's past to haunt her in the present. In this case, though, they have a sort of tense but relatively peaceful conversation, right? Halsey's talking, oh, it's good to see you. He's like, oh, I've played it in my head 1,000 times what I do here. He's like, you're smaller than I remember. And while they're talking, one of these, energy blasts shakes the building and breaks this sort of simulation so they can escape. And Halsey's like, I know where to go and you don't. And he's like, ah, and ends up following her. So they walk together and eventually find Marines with plasma wounds. So they know the stakes. They know the Covenant are here on Reach. So they sort of form this sort of unlikely alliance. And then we do get a little Kessler hint here in terms of plot, Soren's son, because Halsey's very curious about him. She's kind of mad at him for not wanting to talk more about his son. He's like, you're a dad. Aren't you supposed to be gushing about your kids? He's like, not to you. But she wants him to tell her about Kessler, especially if he inherited any of his abilities, right? During the Spartan 2 program, Soren was augmented in many different ways, and she's just sort of curious how Kessler turned out. And so I think that we didn't talk about it for long, but I do think that's a good thing to put a flag in for later. And ultimately, they find Cortana. Halsey takes Soren to Cortana, but unfortunately, McKee is there. She takes Cortana, which is a very big deal, given the intelligence that Cortana has with her. And sadly, they are unable to help because an elite comes and attacks them. And ultimately, they have to go. So they start running to look for others. While that's happening, we go back to what we have here of Silver Team. We've got John, we've got Riz, with them is Talia, and Vanek also is there as well. As they go into Fleet Comm sort of base, they see a bunch of wounded people trying to evacuate. Talia's like, are we done? Are you just going to leave? And he just doesn't even say anything. but then he does eventually flip a coin to her, and he says it's for luck. And so they run into Keyes, who is, as he promised, still there leading the resistance effort. Have a little I told you so conversation there and fill in each other about what's been happening, Ackerson's involvement, what happened to Cobalt Team, all the things we saw last episode. John now knows. And we talk, as I mentioned before, about how we need to stop the power stations from being taken out, because then our space aerial defenses, it's not really aerial, it's stellar defense, I don't know, goes down and the glassing can begin. So they start planning out a defense. They have a choke point on a bridge. And I just thought about this, but I wonder if it's the same bridge that Ackerson's dad was talking about. That would be a fun comparison. What do you think? That's probably true.
I mean, I, in my head canon, I was connecting these bridges, right? Especially when we're doubling down on everything from the antique shop of like, these things matter. The objects that we create have like value. If they don't, then we don't matter. And like all of it, right? So yeah, I think we could like firmly headcanon that one.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so too. And we could even look back at some point, because they look at the bridge from out the window and see if we can figure out if it's the same one. But I think that's either way, it should be headcanon for sure on that. And so at this point, we've got these last standing Marines. Perez eventually sort of snaps out of all of this emotion and all of this overwhelming force and starts helping with transporting the wounded, and ends up being sort of the primary person to deal with evacuating these civilians. Admiral Keyes comes out. He's going to go give a speech. John says, what are your orders? He says, hold my hat, and starts to give a speech. And it's a very classic speech. where, you know, these are the best of us. We are here. We're fighting. Nothing left to prove. And I'll tell you the truth. We're going to die, right? Any Marine who makes this stand is not going to survive. But then he introduces John, brings him up and says, this is John 117. You know him as Master Chief. And you see the hope light up in these people's faces and says, you know, he doesn't even need his armor today. It's the warrior inside of him that's the same as the warrior inside of all of you. And so they are going to lay down their lives to help more innocent people get out of this planet alive who can tell their story. And of course, he ends it with, you know, show those scaly bastards they messed with the wrong planet. And they all cheer and they're ready to go. Keyes wants to fight, but John convinces him not to. They need leaders in the upcoming fight. And otherwise, if it's not him, it's people like Ackerson. And so we get the battle on the bridge. They set up a barricade. We get the giant scorpion tank. We talked about the Wraith. That's the playable Covenant tank in the games. The scorpion is the playable human tank in the games. So we're getting the firepower here. And we have a little tense moment where they fire some white phosphorus because they don't know where the Covenant are. And suddenly they're all there as the bridge lights up. And so during this battle, with a lot of action happening here, we get a really hilarious, awkward, again, elevator scene where Halsey and Soren are walking together and they run into Admiral Keyes. And if you don't recall from season one, Dr. Halsey and Admiral Keyes were formerly married and had a child together, Miranda. And so there's this awkward moment where she says, hello, Jacob. And he says, Catherine. And then Soren. And he's like, he's hilarious in this scene. It's like a side of him I don't remember seeing in the past. Keyes calls him a pirate because he's trying to get out. He's like, I'm a civilian. He's like, no, you're a pirate. And then in the next scene, Keyes asks Dr. Halsey, what is she doing with this person? And he's like, oh, now I'm a person. Oh, we're making progress here. So there's some funny like little comic relief in between as they ride up this elevator and Halsey sort of tells him that Cortana has been taken. And so as this is happening, they're trying to get sort of what I assume is the last civilian transport off of the ground. And Soren is sort of, he picks up a gun. He starts defending as these jackals. We've mostly had elites up until this point. So the jackals are, I always think of them as small, but they're actually still really huge with these like energy shields. And they sort of start to attack. They grapple up to the top of this platform. And there's some battles there. So they actually call Silver Team away from the bridge because the hangar itself is under attack. And as this is happening, they try to take off. Keyes realizes that the fuel lines are still connected. So he tells Talia to go. He gets off the ship. He exposes the fuel lines. And with this exposed fuel, he's surrounded by jackals, puts his cigar, his pipe up to his mouth and says, got a light. And then there's a giant explosion as Talia blasts off with the ship away from the hangar. And as this is happening, right before the explosion, Halsey and John have that reuniting moment where they see each other for the first time since season one. And all this happens before they can react. Now, this is a pretty grim situation for Silver Team, Halsey, and Soren. And again, we get Soren deep in the battle, fighting side by side with Chief. They're doing awesome together. The rest of Silver Team is too, and Halsey's sort of ducking behind the side of sort of a blast door while they're in this fight. And they're, you know, without, despite the fact that they don't have armor, they're doing a good job. But then the Arbiter comes in and there's some swords ignited. And John hurtles out. The Arbiter obviously is interested in having a battle specifically with John. It's, again, this demon concept. I think he's a legend to these Covenant, and the Arbiter wants to battle specifically him. So he just zeroes in on John. They start to battle. The sword literally slices apart John's gun, and then Vanek and Riz are suppressed, so they can't help him, and Chief, this is a really badass moment for like half a second. This is the coolest thing. I literally gasped when I saw him grab that blade of the energy sword and ignite it. So John's finally going to fight with some of the Covenant's own weapons here, grabs the sword, goes to have a battle with the Arbiter. And it's awful, but a little bit funny too, because then the elite next to the arbiter just blasts Chief with a plasma pistol and just knocks him on his back. And like total mood killer. And the arbiter is pissed and just decapitates this other elite. He obviously wanted this honorable battle, and this arbiter is kind of pissed off, but he still goes for the kill for John until McKee comes in and tells him to stop. She says, not yet. At that point, Vanek tries to grab a Covenant needler and starts shooting at the arbiter, but the arbiter takes the needle out of him, stabs it into Vanek, and it super combines and explodes. And we see Vanek lifeless on the ground. And McKee then walks away with the arbiter as John's remaining folks who are there sort of drag him off. He's pretty hurt. And we end the episode with a shot of Vanek laying there on the ground, and it's super sad, right? We see this hole in the building up to the sky, and we see a single bird circling around the hole as we fade to black. And that is our episode, episode 4, Reach of Halo.
In 10 days, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
The pigeons, Corey. Who will feed the pigeons?
I know.
They did a really good job. Like I say, it's like a new viewer coming in. Just that little opening scene. I love the beat of like the animals catching the vibe before we do. The perpetual like Star Warsian like man versus machine, nature versus like the constructions that humanity places to control nature. It's always compelling, the idea there. And so that loss like felt really tangible and impactful in a great way. You know, just to like to the action of it all, especially that initial contact of like them fighting their way through the market, and like John in hand-to-hand combat with these elites, and like Perez with him in the chaos of the crowd was really effective. They were going for like these very long takes, and again, like the vulnerability of John outside the armor. Like, I'm not a guy who spent countless hours in Halo combat, you know, so I don't have like an expectation there. And I found myself wondering, like, is there much in the way of like melee combat or hand-to-hand in Halo? I'm sure you got like your knife, your melee attack, but like, do you ever end up in situations like this where you're in like really pressed melee combat, Corey?
Yeah, I mean, it's the standard video gamey sort of melee combat, right? There's a button where you can whack somebody with your gun.
Yeah.
You absolutely can pick up these energy swords in the game and slash people with them. So there is some level of close quarters combat, even in episode 1, I believe it is, where John starts fighting all these elites with swords, and he's got the shotgun that is right out of the game. The shotgun is like one of the only human weapons that can counteract that sword because it's so potent at close range. And so there is a lot of close range battle sort of feel, but there is not necessarily this like specific hand-to-hand martial combat quite so much, right? It's either just sort of whacking people with their guns. If you get close, they'll try to hit you, but it's not like, it doesn't feel like this.
It's pretty standard, like first person shooter. You got a melee attack for when they like close it. And I got it. I was really curious about it because I felt it was like some of the more compelling action, right? Like, it's one of the things about, I don't mean to keep making the comparisons, but Star Wars, right? Where like, it's always a little bit more fun to watch people with lightsabers compared to like troopers with blasters. There's like only so much we could do with like ranged weapons, you know, to like really make it dramatic. You have to press, and I thought they did a good job there. And then the little bit of like a respite in the antique shop, look, I like heat my house with firewood, so I love, like, I gotta look at that axe. I was like, that's a nice axe, I could use that axe.
All right.
But the whole like conversation that they're having there, like Perez just reminding him of like the humanity that he is absolutely lacking, and him communicating to her the ways that he is like absolutely alien despite being in this like human frame, right? Of like the coin tossing and all of that. I found that stuff really interesting. You know, I could see people like feeling frustrated with this lull in the action, but I think you need it for the pacing. You can't keep like a relentless 40 minutes of combat up, and you need a little bit of like a respite. And I really just like the back and forth between these two. I mean, it's not like the most nuanced or sophisticated writing. It's pretty straightforward, like the exploration that we're doing here of like John's exploration of his humanity and the way that Perez is like this foil for him of like, that was my family. That was not my like combat team. Right. And like, he just does not connect, Corey, you know?
Absolutely. And what I think is interesting about it is a lot of the trait that John was talking about him having, this self-imposed luck, right? This luck that isn't luck because he knows what's going to happen before it happens. And that's the thing in the games too. But that is actually something that he had before the augmentations, before Halsey experimented on him and made him basically a superhuman person, right? Part of me wonders if it has to do with his status as special DNA that makes him one of these sacred humans that can actually activate the artifacts, right? He's got like this interesting like juxtaposition of like the holy, like just very like in tune with everything, in tune with the world sort of side of him, and this robotic, emotionless superhuman soldier side of him as well. And both sides are definitely alien in different ways, if that makes sense. And I think it's something that interesting that I clocked, because like that skill that made him just fearless in the face of all the stuff that's happening is not because he had that emotional palette. It's because he just has this luck that he can seemingly control.
It's a really interesting thing to throw in there. I like read a lot of X-Men comics, and it's like a thing in there that like I go to. I'm very much thinking of Domino, if you've seen like Deadpool 2.
I've seen the scene, yeah.
Right. And so then there's like Foundation recently, an Apple TV. It's an Isaac Asimov adaptation, and they incorporate a very similar idea with the character in Foundation in the show. That's like a major deviation from the text, right? And it was interesting, because initially I think it created a kind of friction that was tough to swallow, but it became a really compelling through line. And again, I'm just tracking like when we get to that whole final encounter with John and the Arbiter and the other one of the Covenant, like I'm still like a little bit on board with the Covenant, and I had read it a bit differently, that like the Arbiter killed the one next to him because he's like, no, we can't kill this guy yet. Like he knew, but to your point, he is like trying to push the fight. It takes like Maquis stopping him. Still, just this whole notion of like this supernatural element, right? There is something like archaic and tied to like Covenant prophecy and Maquis' understanding of John, and like this otherness, this supernatural element that has nothing to do with like the Marines and the military training and any of it, that I'm just curious about. And I wonder, for somebody like you that's super invested in the lore, like how that lands with you, you know? I mean, it's like, I'm curious about it, but I just don't know how much of a deviation it is.
Yeah, sorry, do you mean the
just the whole notion that like he's special that Mikey is like responding him specially. The Covenant seem to like keep sparing him, right? Like they clearly have some type of like prophecy tied up with this guy, or belief around this guy, or are deferring to Mikey. And how much of that is related to like what he's talking about in terms of like his certainty and his conviction and like, yeah.
So from a game universe perspective, the idea of having these, and I can't remember the phrase they use, these sacred ones, blessed ones, what we call reclaimers a lot in the game lore is the official term for them. These humans that can actually activate these forerunner artifacts, these ancient artifacts that came from a race that used to happen, that came from before. And, you know, I actually thought that maybe they would be interested in capturing Chief alive if it were not for the fact that Maquis is somehow still with them, because those are the only two reclaimers that we know. So in that sense, there is a little bit of that in the book, right? Like, or sorry, not in the book, in the games, because, you know, in several times in the games, the Covenant do want to capture humans alive so that they can leverage them to activate and interface with these artifacts, because they themselves are not capable of doing it. It's not in their DNA as a possibility. Although I will say that in the game, every human is a reclaimer. So it doesn't really matter if they captured John specifically or not. But there is still a sense in the games that evolves over time that John is special in a different way. It's the same luck sort of thing that we're starting to see here. And he is part of a sort of special line. It's not just the line that can activate these artifacts. There's a little more of a layer on top special, if that makes sense.
Got it. Yeah, I just was curious how much of that is original. The whole notion of all humans as reclaimers is fascinating. It's interesting to me. It creates like this level of curiosity where I'm like, okay, what's the bigger thing here? Like, why is there this deference? What's with like the genetic coding? I'm really curious to learn more about the Covenant as a newcomer. Yeah. Like, I want clarity on their motivations. I really like getting into like their leadership councils, and like as dysfunctional as it was, the interactions with Maquis and like the leadership of Covenant in season one was interesting. So one, now that we've gotten to like this catastrophic fall of Reach, I'm really curious to see what the other side of this season looks like in terms of what's driving the Covenant here and what their side of this invasion even looks like, you know.
And to your point, that's actually interesting, because Maquis was sort of a character that we related to in season one, right? So we followed her a little more often. We got to see the Covenant capital city of High Charity, and we got to see the three prophets who were in charge. And we're not seeing that this time. Maquis is this mystery. Why is she still alive? What is she doing? And so we're only seeing her in the moments where she wants to be seen. And it will be interesting. I do sort of, you're right, that's sort of an element from season one that we haven't gotten yet. And I do think that the good thing about it is, even if they don't necessarily go there right away, the longer that this show goes on, the more they simply can't do this show without showing us more about the motivations of the Covenant. So it's going to happen eventually, but it would be kind of interesting to sort of maybe start to see, some of the politics again that are happening behind the scenes. But I think we have to sort of uncover the mystery of what's going on with Maquis before maybe they'll pull that curtain.
Yeah, 1,000,000%. I mean, I think you've got the key word there, and it's like mystery, right? I mean, amongst these first four episodes, part of what we have been dealing with in the narrative is like the uncertainty of John's conviction and like the mystery of Cobalt Team and what's going on and how much is Ackerson hiding. And so now that all of that has like played out, there are no longer like, there's still questions in front of us, but there's no big mystery beyond like, what's with the Covenant's plan? What are they doing? Why do they keep sparing time? Right. So that's, I'm excited to get there, you know. But just to the point of like the Marine stuff, tracking John through was really good. You know, the John action is good. Again, like Pablo, this guy is just so big, and I really liked seeing him in the room, like in context with these other Marines. I love the way that they like use the lack of armor as like a reversal, turn your weaknesses into a strength. Let's like capitalize on this moment, right? And then into like, you know, some of the conflicts, like the death of Lewis, the final sacrifice. I will have to say, while they're like fleeing, there's the point where they all jump out the window, and then like John gets tangled up, and then he jumps out the window, and we realize that they've fallen like three stories to the ground. And I'm looking at Lewis like, man, you got some knees on you, old boy.
I mean,
you took that drop like a champion, man.
I mean, I will say, I guess, in defense of the lore, that Lewis did go through the Spartan program. So yeah, he probably is okay. But I mean, that would be
just, after you see John hit the ground, you're like, that was a real drop. Like, I thought they were going to climb out like right onto a roof or something. They just jumped like very far to the ground, you know?
Honestly, I didn't even mention this, I don't think, in the recap, but Danilo gets killed right before they jump out of the window as well, before Lewis dies. And that's part of Lewis's motivation to sacrifice himself. He says, I'm here where I need to be. And to your point, I don't think Danilo was ever making it out that window.
No.
I think either way, Danilo is kind of screwed. And so maybe for the best that that we didn't have to like see him being like, wait, I can't jump that far.
It's such a stupid small beat, but I really appreciated that. This is the thing that I talked about a lot with Grace when we were talking about the fall of Rome. The romanticism that gets tied into like these noble sacrifices. Like, how many times have we watched the action thing of like the hold the door moment? You know, there's always somebody that's going to stay behind and die to get everybody out. And the problem is, half the times like you watch these scenes and the person does not need to stay behind and die, right?
No.
It is this very like Hamilton-esque, they're looking for the easy way out. They want this big, noble, heroic sacrifice. It becomes like a romantic end in this warrior mindset, you know? So I appreciated that Lewis does it, like even to that point, the Admiral, they don't make like these stupid sacrifices out of like the sheer nature of it just for the drama. Like it's not until he realizes Danilo is dead that he's like, all right, I'm done. Like I got nowhere else to go. Now that like my man is gone, I'm going to die here rather than be the blind guy that slows you all down for the rest of the episode, you know? And that like tracks to me. That feels so good in terms of like a trope that we've seen a million times and like a little wrinkle to make it narratively more satisfying, you know?
Absolutely agreed. And that's a great point that I haven't thought of up until then. But yeah, there's so many shows and movies where the guy's just like, you go. And like, wait, why? Like, what?
I mean, it's like a big moment, but like, there's so many things. You could think of a thousand of them, right? Where you're like, why? Why are you doing this?
And both Lewis and Keyes have great, like, actual in-story motivations for why they're doing it. Keyes could have sent a Marine to do it, but he probably... there could be a reason why he wants to do it, but more importantly, he wants to rescue the civilians and he sees the tactical opportunity. He's not blowing himself up for no reason. He just sees the exposed fuel line and he's like, I can take out all these aliens and allow my ship with all of these civilians on it to actually get out of here unscathed. And there's stakes and there's motivations on the topic of... Oh, yeah.
Just the last thing to like the point of Keyes, like Keyes is like, all right, I'm going to go fight with you boys. And it takes John saying to him, dude, are you kidding me? Like, we need you here. You need to like hold back. Right. I appreciate that because it is like this real male machismo, like soldier sacrifice thing. Right. It becomes this romantic end of like dying is easy, Keyes. Living is harder. You got to get these people out of here. So I just like that. You know, it's like an inch that they don't need to go that makes the narrative just that much more satisfying for me.
I agree. And what I was going to say about Keyes too is that I mentioned this in season one. There's a character in the Halo games called Sergeant Johnson. And he is ultimately a character who is the hard ass drill sergeant type character. He's got a ton of personality. He's amazing. So many people were disappointed that he's not in the game or in the show, and warranted, right? I still hope that maybe he shows up at some point, but I also think that they sort of imbued some of his characteristics into Keyes. Keyes in the games is an old white man, ultimately. Even some of this personality of Admiral Keyes lighting up his pipe is classic Sergeant Johnson stuff. Some of the actual speech that he gave, it's not fully there, but it gives me some vibes, right? And I think that I think that there is a little bit of that energy imbued into Keyes, and I love that for his character because it does make it a little more, it gives it a little more stakes when he dies. But also what I was going to mention is that he shouldn't have died here. Like from a game perspective, he is pivotal in moments where they get to Halo. Like he's there. He's the captain of the ship that makes it first to Halo. And so the fact that he died, assuming that he did, but how does he not, is pretty fascinating to me. And I wonder, they could put Miranda in that role, even though we still haven't seen her yet. She's in the credits, I believe, but I'm like, where is she? Keyes admits that she's off planet, but is that just an excuse because they couldn't get the actress? Like there's a lot. I know I'm saying a lot here, but I'm just very curious about what they're going to do with that role that might need to be needed in the future.
That's so fascinating. You know, I mean, in an episode like this, I think again, when we're working with an adaptation, especially one that's making such kind of bold choices and really like deviating from the source material in certain ways, you come to an episode like this and there's often a real like, look, nobody's safe. Like none of your babies are safe, right? What you think you know, you don't know. Check it at the door. This is our own story, right? And I really like appreciate that as like a bold maneuver. It's just sometimes you run into that George Martin problem of like the butterfly effect, right? You like kill a character off that you don't realize how catastrophically you're handicapping your narrative two seasons from now if they should get that far, right? So hopefully they've got like a good plan and an intention here. For me, again, like I just invoke the X-Men because I can't help it sometimes. But like, you know, there's a comic book thing of like resurrection as a trope. It's a thing in D&D. And like when you have resurrection in the story, which I know we're not dealing with as much, we have clones, but it's different. You know, you need to make the death less about the death of the actual character and more about the impact of the death on the other characters, right? How does like that death like drive the narrative forward? What is it adding to the story? So I'm curious to see what they do with this, like in the wake of his loss, how are John and like Riz, I guess it's like the other person here, how are they going to respond and like rise to the occasion? Now that John has like ostensibly been unmasked in front of the others and they know like this is Master Chief's face, they've lost their leader, how will he lead, how will he fill that void? You know, that's kind of where I come away from it, but that's fascinating to know that that's a big change from Malor.
It is, and I do think that they can rise to the occasion. They've got some of, you know, some of the games writers. I mean, I won't get into the two different companies that have made Halo and any of that stuff, but they've got a lot of people who work on the game producing this as well. So I do hope that they're aware of that stuff, and like you said, that they can use this as a moment to elevate the characters that are sticking around. And I do think that they have a good shot too. It's not like Keyes does anything that couldn't be done by somebody else, but it is fascinating if we never see him again. To just that he's gone and seeing what they're going to do. And to your point, you know, we already have the resurrection element with McKee. I was even trying to remember back in the finale, when McKee gets shot, I do know that when John is dying, he does like see her on their little vision halo shared memory sort of thing. So I'm also trying to figure out like in my head, how she came back, because to your point, like I'm thinking about resurrection, I'm like, could that apply to Keyes? But I certainly don't think so. I think the special blessed one sort of thing is mostly why that happened. But yeah, no, I'm sort of spinning here, but I was just curious because I think she did have that shared vision with John as she was dying.
I think you're right. Yeah. And again, like just this question of like the supernatural element. I mean, it's so weird because we're dealing with these elements of mysticism and religion in terms of like the blessed ones and this shared kind of dream state. But then we're also dealing with like super science of like cloning and memory banks, right? And all this kind of stuff, right? So it's a fascinating dynamic in terms of like the push and pull between those things and where it lands. And then the interpretation of the people in worlds to those things, right? The ways that like they're accepted or rejected culturally is interesting. Nonetheless, like the whole, my favorites here, Corey, of like, I got the Halsey Soren double trouble throughout this episode. You know, I love this. It was not like there was anything that dramatic there, but I loved some of the Soren stuff. Like I've been through this before. I've thought about what I'd say, how I'd say it. It's just so like delectable, I think, the delivery for Bokeem Woodbine. And the whole response from her of like the kids and the way that she's pushing back the like Soren, I used, you know, you're smaller than I remembered. I love that like reflection on the kind of dissonance that we have from our childhood memories to what they're like now, you know, like I don't know if you ever had the experience of like going back to your elementary school as an adult and it's like, oh my god, dude, this place is built for midgets, you know.
Absolutely. And what's interesting about it too, and the beat that that I think we didn't discuss yet, is that Halsey not only is like asking Soren about his son, but also she's telling him that she let him leave. And that is just absolutely blows his mind. At some point they stop running. He's like, I need you to tell me more about that. Like, I know we're running away from you know, a devastating alien force, but we need to stop down and talk about this for a second. What do you mean by that?
And it's so great because it just like strips him of, again, his sense of identity, right? Here's this independent pirate lord who got away from like the impossible situation to escape from, but he did it. And in a way it mirrors that confidence that John talks about, right? Like the like, you know, narcissism narcissism is never a tasty flavor to wear, but like that self-assuredness, that conviction, that belief in your ability to achieve is really important. You know, like you need to have some component of ego to drive yourself to do the impossible things. And so to strip him of those victories in retrospect and simultaneously reframe her as no longer like the jailer, but now like the compassionate mother, right? Like not really, but like there is this final like compassion. I loved you enough to set you free, right? Like all of that's really tasty stuff, Corey. Like very compelling.
It really is. And we also get this detail that Soren was the one kid in the Spartan program who was fine with doing it. He volunteered. And to his point, adult Soren says, I was six, right? Like you're really just going to like say, oh, you independently opted into this, you know, augmentation program when I was 6 years old. Can you really say that I made that decision on my own? But yeah, it really flips so much of that dynamic on its head, not just for us as the audience, but for Soren. And to your point, just really, really strips him of that identity. And I think that identity is an element in this episode too, not just with Soren, not just with John, but also with people like Talia, who are trying this entire time to work over this grief and figure out how do you keep going when all this stuff continues to happen? You lose everything and everyone around you. And so there's this element of like loss and rebirth, being rebuilt that is, I think, prevalent in this episode.
For sure. That like, how do you keep going on? I really felt it with Perez as she's like challenged by the face of all of it, the weight of death, the destruction of the kind of world around you. I mean, not to get like too morbid, but as a New Yorker, you know, it very much pulls me back to September 11th. I think it would be like hard for a lot of people not to connect those things in terms of the loss of like this iconic place that you again, like tie your identity to, that your history is tied to. I grew up in like the shadow of those towers, and like you feel that through Perez. Yeah. And it's compelling just in the sense of you know, I'm covering Masters of Air right now with Ariel, and not to like cross the streams too much, but the kind of thesis of Masters of the Air, we're tracking the World War II American bombers that flew B-17 bombers. The completion rate for these guys, Corey, was under 50%. Like they had the highest casualty rate of anybody in World War II on the American side. And even if like they didn't die, I think that something like 30% of them end up prisoners of war by the end of it because their planes are getting shot down. Oh. So the thesis of the show is, how do they keep getting back in the planes every day? Sure. Because these guys knew this. They would fly a mission where 13 planes go out, 17 planes go out, and one returns. And to have to get back in the cockpit the next day, you feel that kind of element through the Perez story here. Yeah. Like, how do you keep doing this? How are you going to like rise in the face of adversity when you are not a super marine? You're just a person who like signed up and enlisted because like you're trying to make money for your family. You come from like a disenfranchised background. It was the best option you had available to you. Like there's so many things that pull people into this calling and this job other than like the noble pursuit of the battle, right? And yeah, and that felt really tangible to me as I'm watching both these shows side by side, you know.
Yeah, I love that. And that is to your point, it's that definitely that same energy. Like when, as you described that to me, I definitely could feel that for sure. And poor Perez, she's, you know, she works in comms, right? She's not supposed to be some soldier or leader out in the front lines doing any of this stuff. And she's thrust into it in this just this wild way. And to your point earlier too, of this like really cool dichotomy in Halo between all this like really advanced high-tech sci-fi stuff and this like stripped down religious aspect. And I think that is really Halo more than anything else. And I think that this idea of these people having faith, not just in a God, but in the ability to like find hope, to keep pushing forward in the face of adversity, and how do they find the strength to move on, I think is really a core tenet of like of Halo. Even though in the games you fight as this faceless suit, you're still typically the only one, you know, in almost any of the situations, especially at the beginning. And there is this element of like, it doesn't seem possible and everything keeps going wrong. And how are we going to keep getting by? And they and far better than the games. The show was really digging deep into that.
Yeah, I feel like they're nailing it. You know, I could see what they're trying to execute on. And sometimes I think it could be more elegant, but I'm sure. Feeling it this season, right? I think that season two, like they've course corrected for a lot of, they're kind of valleys in season one. I think that they've like tightened up their narrative in a way that feels like it's got momentum. It's really like driving forward. You know, I'm engaged and enthusiastic to see what episode six holds for us, or five, sorry.
Episode five, yeah. And most episodes are named after locations. And it's going to be the same thing for episode five. Illyria is the name of a planet that does exist in Halo lore. So it's possible that perhaps that's where we go after Reach. And perhaps we follow some people off planet to get there. But either way, I really don't know what's going to happen here. I presume if anything like the games, Reach isn't going to last. That's the one thing that I can predict with reasonable efficacy, I believe, here as we're going out. But what do you think? What do you think's next in store for us here on episode five?
God, I gotta wonder. I feel like we gotta dial in with Ackerson. We gotta drop in on Kai and reset what's happening there, right? Yes. To your point, just to circle back, like the final stinger, I guess, on the Soren Halsey dynamic. All this stuff about the kid is really interesting to me in terms of like what may have been passed on through the program. Like we've been poking fun at him with his little Master Chief helmet and his action figure so far, but this notion of like an organic Marine to a degree of him like inheriting some of these traits, even just like being raised by a father from the program. It strikes me as really compelling when we're looking at the clone of Ackerson's sister with clarity that she like flunked out of the program. Cause now like to a degree, we got sort of two kid Marines, kind of, not really, but like there's a thing there that I'm curious about. So in terms of like the main through line, I'm curious to just follow John and Riz and like see what this looks like. Is this the end of Silver Team? Is Riz going to be like, look, I'm done, man. We didn't have our armor. Vanek's dead. Kai's AWOL. Like I'm staying here to like honor Lewis's sacrifice or whatever. We've gotten this whole theme of like, there's a different way than being a Marine for her. So that like just getting that clarity from you this episode feels pointed. I'm really curious if in episode five, John and McKee will talk. This feels like the thing we're pushing to, Corey.
I think
like
so
the
too.
Fulcrum moment of like, when will John and McKee like actually exchange some communication with each other? And that will be like a very big pivotal moment of season two, right?
I think it's going to happen. And I think John is also with Halsey, whose first priority is getting Cortana back.
Yes.
And ultimately, I think it's also possible that the Covenant might use Cortana to find the location of Halo, depending on how much information she's got stored in there. Right. And so I think one way or the other, I think that there is at least motivation for John to go after the Covenant, which still could put them in a situation where if the Covenant find Halo, that's where we end up getting there. I really hope that we get there this season. I think it would be a disservice to the show called Halo if we go through two seasons and we don't actually get on Halo.
With you. This is a thing that I've complained about a lot, Corey. Like even for last season of Ahsoka or the first season of Ahsoka, I really liked it, but I do come away with this frustration of like, you guys, especially in today's TV landscape, do not save it for later. Like leave it on the field. Bring your best game. You gotta like try to knock this thing out of the park every single time you're gonna show up at bat, because these like streaming services are all too happy to cancel your show and shelve it in some like digital storage that it cannot be watched by anybody for the rest of time, right? So like, don't F around, Halo, right? Do the thing. Give us the big thing. Don't mess around. So not even knowing what that means, Corey, I agree with you. I want to get to Halo this season, you know?
Totally. And I think the good thing is that we are getting to the Fall of Reach. So and in game canon, finding Halo happens right after that. And so I do hope that there is a good sense that, you know, here we're four episodes out of, I believe, eight total episodes. And I think it's possible. I don't think we're going to be there long if we get there, but I think it's possible that we at least get there by the end. So definitely crossing my fingers for that. And I think I'm on the same page as you in terms of potential trajectory in the meantime. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, me too, man. I thought it was a pretty solid one, you know, very fun, kinetic hour of TV, which is always something I appreciate.
Yeah, likewise. And so if you all out there enjoyed this podcast, please be sure to check out postshowrecaps.com/halopod to subscribe, or just subscribe to Post Show Recaps. We will be back for episode 5. I'm going on a trip. We may have some scheduling constraints, but we'll try to get it out to you as soon as it airs. And if not, we may take a week or so off, depending on how we can put together our schedules here, but we will ultimately be back with coverage of episode 5, Illyria, and beyond. As always, Rich, thank you so much for being here and helping out. Where can people chat you up on the internet?
Yeah, delighted to be here. A good call on the scheduling. No, I'm at DM Philly in all the places. Go hit me up. I'm on Twitter. I'm on the other socials, but I'm rarely on them. Twitch.tv/DM Philly. You can go give me a follow there for when I go live streaming some D&D. If you want to catch some old D&D, it's over on the YouTube channel of the same name. And yeah, Masters of the Air. I'm covering it with Ariel right now on PSR. It's pretty good. Cool stuff. I'm digging it so far.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds great. And you can find me and most of the places at Cavix, C-A-V-X. And feel free to chat us up. Leave us any feedback that you've got for these episodes or what you're generally thinking about the show. And we'll look forward to seeing you next time. As always, it's been a pleasure. And as we sort of bound off from Reach, we will see you wherever we end up landing next. And until then, hope you have a great one. See you later.
Halo, it's Chief. Show the face to all the Covenant and Dr. Catherine Halsey. You've been